Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. On this episode, we're lucky enough to have Jeff Shiner, CEO of 1Password, although he just goes by Shiner. So Shiner, thanks for doing this.
Hey, happy to be here.
So I want to talk about how to grow a company. As I understand, about 11 or 12 years ago, when you took over, there was like 20 people on the team, and now there's 900. And like, correct me here, I think the last thing I saw was like, you guys had raised, I don't know, $660 million at a $6.8 billion valuation. Are my numbers close there?
Yeah, the last raise was 620 at a $6.8 billion valuation. That's correct.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So I was very happy when I saw you on the schedule because I've been a LastPass guy for years and I'm so frustrated. And we have a family member that just switched to 1Password and is like talking to the rest of us of like maybe everybody, because now I'm like my whole companies are all LastPass and we are very susceptible to become customers of yours. So help us understand why companies specifically would be interested in becoming a client.
Yeah. So when we look at 1Password, there's a couple of things that are just absolutely fundamental to us, right? And one of them is making it easy for human beings to stay secure. And that to me is, you know, sure, first 10 years we were consumer only. And I think that led up to why we're so usability focused, why we're so human focused. But at the end of the day, you know, you're Jess, I'm Shiner, we're people. We work sometimes, we're at home sometimes, but we're people. And you have to make it easy for people. Otherwise, they're not going to use it or they'll just pretend to use it. So when we took that focus, we took it to businesses and we said, you know, in order to be secure, your employees need to be secure. You look at it today, still 75% of all breaches are a result of humans. It can either be weak passwords, reused passwords, phishing. I mean, look at how much phishing has just increased over the last year. And so you've got to make it that the end employee can stay secure. And in order to do that, you actually have to give them something that's going to remove friction instead of add friction. And almost every security tool I know adds friction to their life instead of removing it. So we really focused hard on how do we actually make it easier? How do we actually make it so that the employees like, oh, like they forget that it's keeping them safe. And they're just like, yep, this is the one that makes my life easier. Then they'll use it. Then the businesses benefit.
So I'm sure you don't want to talk bad about your competition. So I will. LastPass is giving me so much friction. It's always bumping me out when it shouldn't. And like, it's just multiple points of friction repeatedly. And hence the reason that we're like, this is not the level of reliability we need. When you think about other folks in a similar space, what are some of the 1Password advantages?
So again, as you said, usability is first and foremost in my mind. Security is another one. So I'm going to talk security a little bit. And one of the big challenges and one of the big questions about password management in general is, well, doesn't that give us one place where all of my passwords are, and isn't that a wonderful target? So from the day we designed our backend, our SaaS solution, I said, if our data were ever taken, it would have to be useless to whoever could take it. Now, the normal way that companies say they do that is like, oh, well, we just use client-side encryption. We don't have the ability to decrypt the information. And they're correct. But the big problem is that client-side encryption depends on your master password. And who chooses a master password? A human. So if the data is ever taken, all of a sudden the threat actors are sitting there. All they have to do is guess. So we ran an interesting experiment, and in fact, an interesting competition at 1Password. And we ran it a couple of years ago. And what we did is we said, hey, we're going to encrypt this fairly straightforward password, and we're going to have a competition. We're going to give out, I think it was like 25,000 to whoever decrypts it the first, 12,000 for a second. And that allowed us to see how easy it is for an average password to be decrypted. And effectively, what they do is they guess, right? It's a password guessing routine. The end result is $100 worth of electricity gives you 10 billion guesses. And that's how it works, because they work it very similar to crypto. They just go and rent a bunch of GPUs and they do that. So you think of it, your account password, your master password that you choose, is it protecting more than $100 worth of stuff? Of course. Do you think it can be guessed in 10 billion guesses? And the answer for a lot of us is yes. So that was the problem. So what we did was we introduced what we call the secret key, which is nothing more than a machine-generated password. So you choose your account password. Let's say it's Fluffy Cat. Shouldn't be, but let's say it is because we're humans. It has to be rememberable. And then we will generate this big, long, completely unguessable machine key that also stays only on your device, never gets to us. So that way, you've got this completely unguessable key that's protecting your data. Great. Security is easy to make secure, really hard to make easy. So you're not going to remember this big, long key. So what do? We keep it on your device, on all of your devices. That way, you only have to remember Fluffy Cat, your master password, and then the key is provided for you. Because again, they're not trying to get into your machine. If they are, it's your account password, your master password that protects it. It's if they get this whole sum of data from us that they can start that guessing, in which case it's completely useless. So security, you know, there's a lot of technical mumbo jumbo in there, but the security is extraordinarily important for two reasons. One, because I want to be able to sleep at night. I want all of our customers to be able to sleep at night knowing that if anything were to happen, the data is useless. And second of all, we make that very public. We put it up on our website. We've got white papers and everything. It makes us less of a threat because they know they won't get anything of value.
That makes sense. How many consumer accounts do you think you have and how many businesses do you think you help protect?
Yeah, we protect well over 100,000 business accounts. And I like to clarify that by saying paying because we don't have a free tier. I know some do. So all of those well over 100,000 business accounts of all sizes, from the very small to the largest of Salesforces and IBMs and that are protected by us, and millions of consumers.
And when did you start at the company?
When did I start? I started July of 2012, I think is when I started, roughly almost coming up on 12 years ago.
Yeah. When you think about this incredible growth over that time, what's a lesson that you would have for other CEOs listening today that maybe you didn't, there wouldn't have been another way for you to know it than actually living the life you've lived?
Yeah, there's a couple. As you can imagine, and like I said, at the time we were 20 people, we're actually up to 1,200 now, so it keeps growing quickly. At every size, at every doubling, and I remember when I joined, I told, Dave, Sarah, Rustam, and Natalia, who were the founders, I said, like, I'm going to double the size of the company. And at the time, I was like, what are we going to do with all these people? And later on, they asked me why double. And it's like, I can look at Sue, or I can look at Joe, or I can look at an individual person. I can, like, they're really good. They're really busy. Man, I would love to have another one of them. It's harder for me to look at it and say, what would I do with the 10 more Sues? And so it's always easy to double, but doubling grows very quickly. So you go from 20 to 40 to 80, But at each doubling, and sometimes even in between, how you approach the company has to change. And it, when you're early on, I remember we had a circle. We literally had a circle. We would gather everybody together. We're a remote company. We'd bring them to an offsite. We'd gather all of them in a circle. And then we would just talk about our plans, answer questions one-on-one, and do all of that. And then I remember the next year, we were too big for a circle. So we called it a squircle because we just layered ourselves in a square on the other side of the room and we had a squircle. And then, now with 1,200 people, we have to do it with a fairly large production. And we did it remote this year, but it's, we have a stage in a production company and we have to make the message extraordinarily clear because now it's not nearly as interactive. It's one on 1,200, but at every stage it changes. So don't try and keep what worked for you when you were smaller and say, well, it's going to work for us as we grow. Just expect to continue to change and in meaningful ways.
So I have a related question. This podcast is so fun. I get to learn from so many different leaders from different industries and from outside of business and all these things. And then a number of them kind of become, some are acquaintances, but some become real friends. We're texting and have calls and hang out stuff. And I've had CEOs of really quite large companies talk to me about this concern of wanting to be loyal to the people who were early on in the business. But back then they needed a generalist. And now they've got all these specialists. And even though people aren't the fit anymore, they have this loyalty to them and they have a lot of internal anxiety of what how to do right by the company, how to do right by these people who helped build the company. And it's like a lot of like personal anxiety. What kind of advice would you have for folks who are struggling in that with like the business's needs have changed, but the staff have the skill set we hired them for when we were the old kind of business?
Yeah, it's real. 100% is real. And, you know, in hindsight, I would say do what's best for the person. Yeah, you know, because I won't, you know, give names, but there was a couple of the folks that, to your point, they were generalists. And when you're a generalist, you're often the most valuable person at a small company. And then as you grow, you know, they may want to stay a generalist, but all of a sudden you need specialists in each area. And in some cases I hung on, you know, like we'll find a role, because to your point, like I feel fierce loyalty to my folks, but I misplaced that at times. I misplaced that as, and the right thing for them to do is to stay at our company. At times it absolutely is. And that, but at times the best thing for them is to sit there and say, you know, I think you'd actually be happier elsewhere. How do we do right by you, help you find a role, you know, be generous in either a package or just in the time we give you, and start to realize what's actually better for that human being, for that person, as opposed to looking at it and saying, well, what's clearly right for that person is to stay at this company. I do, however, find that a number of those folks that are the generals make the best managers over time. Because they can call BS when they need to on individual things because they understand it, but they can actually help guide people even though they may not be somebody who's just going to focus on a one particular area. So that's the other side of it that we have found, where they've moved from sort of a role where they're the doer into a role where they're the leader. And not everybody does that, but that can work quite effectively as well.
It's interesting to think of how like some set policy of everybody needs to stay forever is not actually being that alive to the human, is it?
They're your friends, right? They're especially the folks that, like I say, you sat around the circle with. They're your friends, and they've helped you build, you know, this great product and help these people, and they're a big part of your lives. And you're right, you get caught up in the, well, you know, this is the best place for me. It must be the best place for everyone. And sometimes it's not. And I've found in my experience that we hang on too long, and then that relationship can even start to turn into one of angst, as opposed to leaving early enough that everybody can be, you know, can be happy with that relationship. But it's just tough, you know, from an emotional perspective to get yourself to think that way.
Yeah, entrepreneurship is a full contact sport, isn't it?
It is. It certainly is.
Another question I'm super interested in is, when you think about fundraising, right? So many of us, whether it's nonprofit, whether it's for-profit, there's so many people, you know, you could be an investment fund looking for LPs, entrepreneur looking for an investment fund, whatever it is. Fundraising is something that there's so few people that feel like they completely know it. Like everybody's always interested in one more fundraising tip. Whatever. When you think about raising $620 million at one point, that's a sizable transaction, my friend. What fundraising advice do you have for the rest of us that hope to grow into transactions of that size?
So, you know, the easy thing for me to say, which is absolutely the real thing, is be very purposeful about your fundraising. We were in the very fortunate position. I mean, we put ourselves in that, so I'll give ourselves some credit, but we were in the fortunate position where we didn't need the money for the sake of the money. So we had, you know, we had to look at what was the value of our fundraising. So for instance, the first fundraise, which we did back at the end of 2019, at the time, it was half of us were engineers, half of us were customer support. Build a good product, support the heck out of your customers. That's how I want to lead the company. But at the same time, as we were growing, we needed world-class go-to-market. You know, we had bigger and bigger customers. We wanted world-class marketing to make more people aware. We wanted to, you know, stop doing cash accounting in QuickBooks and, you know, do real accounting and all those sorts of things. I didn't know how to attract world-class talent to be leaders in those areas. We were very private, so people didn't know if we were successful or not. And so the fundraise was certainly, it was a way to, you know, to raise some money and to get what I call courage capital. I actually stole that term from our our investor, so that we could do something with it because we didn't need it to, you know, to pay payroll. But it was also an opportunity for us to come out to the, you know, to the world as it was and say, hey, we're doing well, we're successful, we're growing. We would like people, you know, who are in great leadership positions to come work with us. And then I hired Jeannie as my, you know, CFO as my first exec, and now we've got a full team. When it came to the, you know, to the $620 million round, I'll share a little bit of inside baseball on that, but when it came to the $620 million round, that was all about two things at its core. One was how to raise a significant amount of Courage capital so that we could start looking at how to accelerate our mission through things like M&A, which we've actually acquired three companies since. And it was also to bring on, you know, the first VC we brought in was Accel. And then now, as we were starting to get more mature, I wouldn't call us mature, but, you know, more mature, it was Iconic. And Iconic was somebody who could really help us grow through our next stage of growth. And Will and the team there is fantastic. So it was that combination. And then the other thing that we did at the time, which you know, was a little, I think in hindsight, brilliant. It's not me, but it was the team. And it was, we brought in a number of investors who were superstars, right? We brought in the Ryan Reynolds and the Trevor Noahs, and even, you know, on the business side, the Mary Barras, and then we brought in a lot of those folks. And part of the reason for doing that was marketing. How do we get our name out to the every person? Because again, the financial papers and that will pick up a large transaction, but you know, most people aren't going to care. But having Ryan Reynolds invest and you know, and folks like that are going to bring a level of visibility where they're actually giving us money instead of the amount of money I'd have to give them back to give that visibility. But we were going to raise, I think it was 600, I think was the number. And so the little bit of inside baseball that I think is fine to share is like we were going to raise to 600 million, but we found out that the top raise in Canada in, you know, Canadian dollars converted to US would have been like 610. So we raised 620. So we could say we had the largest ever raise in Canada. So that was why 620.
Okay. So as a fellow Canadian, like yourself, growing up there, how much of the Ryan Reynolds connection was it a Canadian connection that got you to him?
So yes and no. I would, you know, again, when we look at it, we reached out to a number of, we actually built a list, both of business leaders that we wanted, businesses that we wanted, and, you know, athletes and movie stars and stuff like that. We didn't get everybody, you know, that we wanted, but we got a number. But yes, folks like Ryan Reynolds, top on our list. I'll tell you why he's top on at least my list. Absolutely. Canadian. That's, you know, look, we've got hundreds of folks in
Wayne Gretzky, Ryan Reynolds,
but yeah, like it's, we still are, you know, Canadian born. And so that was one. He's also one of the nicest people again. And has only proven that out as I've actually gotten to know him personally a little bit, you know, like he always comes across that way, but he's one of the nicest people, whip smart. You know, I hate to say I'm surprised by that. I didn't have an opinion one way or another, but whip smart. But he's everything that I think, you know, we would want to represent one password, which is why afterwards we did that commercial with him as well.
So fun. If people haven't seen the commercial, where is the best place to see it? Is it on YouTube or?
Yeah, YouTube. Just it's actually with his Wrexham football team. So you can watch the commercial on YouTube, or if you watch the Wrexham,
Welcome to Wrexham.
Yeah, that series, you can actually see a part of the making of the commercial in that series because it was actually made during a game.
That's so fun. When you think about people like that, did you guys go the traditional route and reach out through their agent, or was it trying to find a friend of a friend, or? You know, these people have a lot of gatekeepers.
Yeah, it was largely through Iconic. It was largely through, you know, people who knew people who knew people. I don't know how many levels. What I thought was a ridiculously fun, but also fascinating was in the end, I got to speak with most of them directly. So they would set it all up and then I'd get to speak with them because of course they want to learn about the company and I'm just like starstruck. But it's wonderful how many of those folks use 1Password. And, you know, I think everybody should use 1Password, but I was asking them why, you know, so many of the celebrities, and they made a really good point. You know, for the most part, most people aren't being targeted, right? Again, if you look at the threat actors, they'll go after companies or they'll go after groups of people. Like, can I get 1 million users from company X? But there's folks like that. Certainly, again, you can imagine politicians or top business leaders and celebrities where people will actively go after them. And so they need more than the average person to stay protected. And that's why so many of them related to 1Password and used 1Password. So it was, you know, it made sense for them to hop on the cap table.
That's great. So what about the actual presentation? Let's talk nitty gritty. When you're asking for $600+ million, any tips to both being your best self when you have that presentation and the actual flow of a presentation? Any like, you know, behind the scenes there?
I struggle with this question because it's going to sound a lot more like bragging than I mean it to, but we never really created presentations. We were very fortunate in that, for lack of a better word, we were pursued by a number of the VCs. Now, don't get me wrong, they did full due diligence and we shared our numbers, but we never actually created a pitch deck per se. And so that's something that I can't give a lot of guidance on, but what I will say, and of course, like, if your company needs money, you're going to have to go and create a pitch deck. That's certainly the case. But one of the things that I would, you know, try and stress people who are starting up a business is try and grow that business profitably if you can. It's not always going to be possible. Sometimes you need to be the first to market or it's going to be a race and you have to dominate and you're going to have to take that funding. But it is something that you know, Dave Saravistam and Natalia from the very beginning and even through this day, we sit there and say, like, we want to have a lot of thought put into how we grow the company. We want to be ambitious. We want to make sure we spend for today, spend for the future. But we also want to look at it and say, I like to say there's a big difference between a customer and a user. A customer is going to show you where the value is with their money, with their words as well, but with their money. A user is going to sit there and potentially tell you how great you are until you ask them for money or until you ask them for an amount that you know, covers their cost. It's, you know, it's the old, you could have a great idea, you go around to all your family and friends and ask them and they're all going to give you that's awesome. But if you go around to all of them and say, well, you give me $1,000 to buy this, I don't have the money, I've got one already. You know, there's a difference there. So I would say, since you can, really start from day one. And whether it ends up profitable or just under, if you can demonstrate that purposeful spending, you know, that you're getting a return and it's not just buying users or growth for the sake of growth, you will generate a lot of interest in the investment world.
That's great. What's another $6.8 billion success secret for us?
You know, it's interesting. So on the weekend, I was at a university and they had, it was like the university's Tech X group for the university students that want to be entrepreneurs. And the one question there to us as a panel was like, how do I know if I have a $1 billion idea? And I said, well, I don't know if there's necessarily $1 billion ideas, but without question, there are $1 billion problems. And so I said, find the problem that either you face or others that you know, like very concretely face, and then just listen to your customer. So to me, a great example from a 1Password perspective is, you know, through the first, you know, 10 years or so, we were a consumer app. And when it came to 2013, I started to see a shift in businesses. We didn't have a business solution. We didn't even have a SaaS solution. It was just a licensed consumer version. But I started to notice businesses taking an interest, whereas previously the odd business would actually buy copies of 1Password for their employees for Christmas to keep their, you know, employees safe. Now they started to buy copies of 1Password for their employees to keep their business safe. And I started to recognize that shift simply by, you know, watching our customers and then listening to our customers. And so that's when I said in 2014, okay, we're building a B2B app. It took us 2 years. We launched it in 2016, but that had a huge, you know, hockey stick impact growth to our company. And again, it's all because your customers will tell you what's valuable, what problems they're facing that they need help solving, and perhaps more importantly, which ones they think you're the right person to help solve versus somebody else.
I think that that is such a great construct because there it's so much more quantifiable. Is this a billion-dollar problem, right? Is this idea going to be a billion-dollar company? Like, there's so many things that, you know, it's like, maybe. But the idea of, like, is this a billion-dollar problem, that feels like you can really sink your teeth into it and you could probably get to a higher level of objectivity about it, right?
Yeah, it starts to become more tangible. It's the same sort of question I had. One of the students asked me, like, should I stay really niche or should I go broad? And I said, well, again, I relate it back to the problem. We call it TAM or whatever, you know, total addressable market or whatever, you know, fun term we want. But it's easier to sell to a niche, or it's easier to build a solution for a niche. Is that, you know, whatever number you want to say, is that the billion-dollar problem, or is it at that level a $10 million problem? In which case you have to look, does that problem still exist at a broader level? But to your point, you can really start to look at it tangibly and sit there and say, what is the problem? Is the problem unique, or is it really, you know, manifested in 10 different sub problems? And how many of those do I have the, you know, the right to solve? And yeah, you can really start to understand how you'd approach it and then make your decisions from there. It all sounds easy. Yeah. So there's still an awful lot of hard work that goes into it.
Yeah. What was one of the hardest times in the business? What's one of the lows that you had to make it through?
I think that it's interesting from a business point of view. I would say, and you know, even the last couple of years, there's, as you know, you watch sort of the tech community sort of took a dive mid, you know, 2022. In many ways, it's been very positive for us because we do have the funds and we can continue to grow and be at strength. But it's still a challenging area because you really have to overthink your decisions from like a people perspective. So again, like, we wanted to continue to grow and we have, but at the same time, I want to be cautious not to put myself in a position where I'm having to do layoffs or things like that. And so it becomes a case of there's things out of my control, and the macroeconomics are largely out of your control. Will inflation continue and it get worse? Will it get better? So what I find is those are the areas that in retrospect can be the most impactful. But while you're going through it, it just seems like the, you know, the problems are surrounding you and you know, you're searching for that bright light to say, like, go in this direction. But it won't be there. You have to just, you know, I'll take a phrase from, gosh, a leader, my manager back in the, what was it, late 90s. And he made a comment to me once that stuck with me ever since. And that is, a leader leads. You're not a leader by title, by this, by that, but because you have to say, we're going in this direction. And yeah, you may have to sit there and say 6 weeks later, well, that was the wrong decision. But you have to lead. And I think that's some of the hardest times is when you have to face all of those unknowns and then just, you know, say, this is where we're going.
Well, I want to keep digging into this. Now, it might be hard for a Canadian to say something nice about themselves, but there's so many entrepreneurs that would like to have achieved the level of success you have, that would like to have grown their company into the billions like you have. And they're so, statistically, just so, so few that have accomplished it. What do you think is different about you? Or what do you think you've done differently than maybe others haven't done?
If I look at what I think are my strengths, it's I think the ability to surround myself with, you know, people that are far smarter than me, which is, I think, something that you have to put your ego in check. And you have to sit there and say, yeah, this person's going to make me look good. Whereas, you have the, you know, you want to, as a leader, to always be smarter than the people you have. You want to be right more than the people you have. Like, you want to be that rock. And that's completely understandable. And I'd completely admit that I'll feel that way sometimes, but it's the wrong way to be. And so the nice thing in some ways about a CEO is everybody I hire has to be smarter than me in their role. I mean, like I said, Jeannie was my first executive hire as my chief financial officer. Melton, who's my chief marketing officer, like, I did marketing at 1Password for a while before we had a marketing team. Now, what I did was just go to Google AdWords and, you know, look at it and go, oh, let me try this. But it's not really marketing. And so it, in some ways, it makes it easier. But I do find you have to have that ability to surround yourself with really smart people. You have to then get those people to trust that you will listen to them, but then also trust that you will help make that decision and take that direction. And I think that's something that, you know, again, a lot of people can do. I do sometimes see just the, you know, my way or the highway personalities become some of the CEOs. And I'm not going to say that you can't lead in that direction. It certainly wouldn't work for me.
So let's talk about the combination there. When it does come to these times that, like, you are the leader, you need to lead. Like, everything can't be done by committee, right? Like, I feel like there's such a balance between, like, you fall off this side, and it's like my way or the highway. And then you fall off this other side, and the leader isn't actually leading. They're just, like, you know, having a social party and trying to get consensus on something, right?
Yeah.
And for me, and I want you to tell me if you feel differently, like, I think a lot of the leaders I look up to the most, whether it's special ops guys or business guys, investment guys, whatever, you know, like, I've got these great, like, women nonprofit leaders on who, like, we had one on a week and some ago who, she ran orphanages for 15 years and then come to find out, like, 80% of children in international orphanages have one living parent, and they just typically can't afford their own kid. And it's actually, like, 80% cheaper to fund the parent than to fund the orphanage. And here she is with thousands of donors and years of built up and a big reputation. And she, like, decided, nope, we are getting out of the orphanage business and we're getting into the adoption business. And she turned these orphanages all around the world, India, Africa, into, like, centers to help fund a parent, if there's a living parent or a living grandma or somebody, or those kids that there really is no one, the other 20%, like, getting them adopted into a forever family. And it's like, wow, the humility to, like, go tell all your donors, we've been doing it wrong. The, like, all the infrastructure and the accolades she's received for this, like, to, no, we're like, we are taking a right-hand turn here, people, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, it's like this, like, they do listen, they get expert advice, but then they're also willing to be the leader and make the choice and step out into the uncertainty and, like, take the risk of being wrong. When you think about that decision tree of, like, when to listen to everyone else and when to trust everyone else and when to trust yourself, how do you think about that decision tree?
So more and more I look at it in terms of roles, responsibilities, and then conflict. Or conflict may be maybe analysis by, you know, paralysis analysis. And so if we look at it and we say, you know, we're trying to make a decision around something from a go-to-market perspective. You know, maybe what is the next market we're gonna hit? I'm gonna look at it, I'm gonna say, you know, Julian, my chief revenue officer, he's right there in the trenches with his team, and he sees it. So as much as I might have an instinct that X is right, I'm going to rely more on Julian. Now, to your point, if it's not an instinct but a firm belief, I'm gonna go with my firm belief, and where that magic line lies, it's, you know, it's a big gray line, right? And probably depends on far too many frivolous things than any of us would like to care about. But, you know, for the most part, I'm going to count on him. You know, if I look at Steve Wan, who's our chief product officer, and he's like, hey, you know, customers are going to really require feature X before we can, you know, bring this live. Okay, I'm going to trust that and know that he's done the customer research and things like that as well. It's not just willy-nilly. It's a lot of that. But what we find happens at times is where it becomes a little bit of paralysis by analysis, where, you know, speed to market, we need this feature. And then what can happen is we just get to a loggerheads, and that's where I'm going to make a decision. I'm going to, again, listen to everybody and make a call. And if the answer were obvious, I wouldn't need to. And certainly the more you grow your team and the more your team's together, and that's something now that we've seen, you know, from a 1Password point of view, where 4 years ago that I was just building the team, now the bulk of the team's been together for, you know, at least a year, and in some cases three years, it's a lot easier to come to consensus. We can see the same things, we rely on the same data, but there's still times when it's like, nope, this is what we're doing. And, you know, I think part of it in the end is, not only am I making the decision, but I'm taking the responsibility. And there is still a time when you want to take the responsibility on things that you don't want your team to feel responsible for if either it's too big of a decision or too broad of a decision. Because that's another area where I find they can start to pause, right? And want more and more data. And there's times when I'm often asked, like, what's the thing I worry about the most? And it's not moving at the speed of technology. And it's something we still struggle with today. How do we, you know, move faster? Move faster doesn't mean type faster, doesn't mean work faster. It means focus more, do less, but accomplish, you know, that less quicker and make it more compelling, as opposed to the, you know, just doing anything that comes across our plate. So there's a lot of gray lines in there, and you just have to be the one that says, we need to move forward more than we need to continue analyzing.
Yeah. When you think about this go-to-market strategy, you know, you've already got millions of individual users, over 100,000 business clients. What's a go-to-market philosophy that you guys have embraced, or what's kind of your mindset in the go-forward right now when you're already a $6.8 billion company and now you need to get to the next level?
So there's a saying, I mean, it's certainly not unique to me, but there's a saying I've been saying internally, which is, you know, growth at scale is new markets and new products. And so when we look at it, when we focus on that, you know, said perhaps better, that's how I said it, but said perhaps better is new markets and new problems. But, you know, from a market point of view, so, you know, MSP is a market, so managed service providers is a market that we've not addressed. And, you know, we've just announced the MSP solution at the MSP Expo was last month. And, you know, are working very hard on the MSP offering. And, you know, what we've come to realize is there's a whole set of small businesses and millions of people that go with it that they aren't going to be large enough or perhaps sophisticated enough to have their own, you know, cybersecurity team or perhaps even IT team. And they're going to, you know, they're going to have an MSP or an MSSP service that. And they all still need password managers. They all still need to keep their business safe and their employees secure. And so that's something that we've been working hard on. And it came about, you know, in large part, especially as we started to look more and more internationally. We sell to, you know, well over 100 countries, but our sales team is still largely, you know, more localized. And so as we continue to grow outwards there, we started to see more and more of a need on the MSP market. So that's certainly an area that we've been expanding into.
Yeah, it's funny. It's so simple when you say it that way. It's like, oh yeah, duh.
Yeah. How come it's not done yet? Like, I talked about this a week ago.
Yeah, that's so great. Well, listen, if people want to sign up or learn more, where are the best places for that? They want to follow you. Are you on LinkedIn or what do you want to send people today?
So yeah, 1Password.com, by all means, go there. It's a free trial. If you're a business, you can sign up either for a free trial or just reach out to our sales team. We're happy to call you back from a consumer. And I would say even more than an individual, a family account is really important for the consumers, and get your family on 1Password and try it there. For me, if you want to reach out to me, it's LinkedIn. I'll put in a plug for me on Instagram because I think it's jshiner_eh because I'm Canadian. But that's all about me and my tractor hobby. So you won't find much 1Password there. But if you want to see somebody who knows very little about what they're doing, fix tractors, that's where I'm at.
That's so fun. Well, maybe to kind of end off, what's one of the best pieces of advice you ever received? for your business world?
Yeah, I think the best piece of advice that I received, there's sort of two. One is again, I go back to Mike Polden, who, you know, in the 90s when I worked at IBM, and I wanted to be a team lead, and our team lead had left, and I went to Mike, who was my manager. I'm like, I want to be a team lead. And he's like, okay, but I'm not going to tell anyone. And I'm like, what is this? Like, I'm thinking like this is, you know, this guy's a, you know what? And, you know, turns out he had told three people that it had come up to ask. And, you know, 6 months later, I was just the leader. And his comment to me at the time, you know, 6 months later was, a leader leads. So just go out and lead. Don't wait for somebody to give you a title or give you the authority. And that's really stuck with me. Like a leader leads. It doesn't mean you don't listen to people in that, because that's, you know, being a leader is all about listening to people smarter than you, but just go out and lead. And I think that was huge. I would say the other one from a business point of view, I'm going to stick with it because it's just been so incredibly valuable. Listen to your customers. Just treat your customers as gold. They will tell you where the value is, and they will tell you how to expand.
I'm going to ask one last one on that one. I think we'd be hard pressed to find a CEO who says, I don't listen to my customers, right?
That's right.
But then I get those of you who built these businesses into the billions, there's like a different tone of voice. It's like you guys mean it more. There's something deeper to it that I hear out of the few of you that I get to meet that have done this at the level of billions. Would you put any context of what kind of listening, or how to not just like have happy ears and listen for confirming evidence, or what could you add to how we should listen to our customers?
I'll share with you something that we did for many years. We do it in different ways now because we've grown too large, but for many years we used to have what we called CS Monday, or Customer Support Monday. So we had a dedicated customer support team, but every Monday the entire company, I mean myself, the founders, the engineers, everybody would do customer support in different ways, some in the forums, some in the, you know, support queues and that. And the purpose was to sit there and make sure we understood what the customer was feeling. We're all customers of our own, you know, our own product, but like, what are the rest of the customers feeling? And you quickly start to realize, like, a developer always wants to build the next feature. And so, I mean, that's what I grew up as a developer. And then all of a sudden they're like, this is the third customer that I've had to tell, yeah, that sucks that it has this problem. And now you're super motivated to go fix that problem, right? Like that's just the level of, like, your customers are everything, because they're telling you what they like. They're telling you what they don't like. They're advocating on your behalf to everybody else. Like it's a relationship. It's a real relationship. And it's one that is precious and I suspect easy to lose.
And then what about, that's great. I appreciate that. And it, again, sounds so simple. No wonder it works so well. Let's talk about at the enterprise level, you know, where you've the person who's writing the check at IBM or whatever giant company, right? Who are not, they're not calling the customer service line. Like, you're probably going to have to go find them or something. What does listening look like the person who writes the check at the giant enterprise account?
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of the natural, you know, what problems are they having? But I think the biggest value that I get out of them is going and saying, what problems are you facing that you think we should be solving for you? And just constantly asking that question. Because again, they're going to face a whole bunch of problems that are completely unrelated to our field. But if all of a sudden they come and they say, well, you know, over the last 5 years, like, our employees, now they work from wherever and they work on their own device as well as company devices. And they're working on these apps that, you know, like these SaaS apps that we have no idea where they're at. Like, how do I get a sense of that as a business? You know, how do I start to solve that problem? And I'm like, we can help with that. And so that's where, again, the customers can do that. And then, of course, you know, then you can do the more formal programs afterwards of like, hey, what customers want to more formally help us. But it's just, again, it's just, I hate to say caring, because it sounds silly, but it's so true. Just like, care about the problems your customer has, because it's very selfish. Like, you can do it with all the good intent, but it's also very selfish, because it's ultimately going to, if it's something that matters to them, it's something that if I can help them solve that problem, they're going to care about me.
Oh, I think that's a mic drop. I don't think we can top that. This is so great. Listen, thank you for spending the time here today.
That's been a lot of fun.
Okay, bye everyone.